the role of the newspaper and the role of the stories that I tell, that I hope that they function sort of like the circulation system or the blood vessels of a body function, carrying oxygen throughout the entire body, keeping the toes alive, right? The toes are out there, but they better be connected or they're going to fall off, you know? And so that I like to think that these stories that circulate through the community and kind of oxygenate the community and keep people bound to it and interested in feeling a part of it and feeling in the know.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to episode 3 of the Austin Meyer podcast, where we talk to the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. Today on the show, we have an interview with a newspaper columnist named Chris Smith. Chris Smith has been working at my local hometown paper, The Press Democrat, for 41 years. And this is a paper that I'm really proud of. They actually won the Pulitzer Prize this past year for breaking news coverage when in October 2017, wildfires just destroyed so much of our community. They did an amazing job covering that and were justifiably rewarded the Pulitzer Prize, which is very exciting. And we'll talk more about that in the episode. But I was excited to have Chris Smith on the show because as far as newspaper reporters go, he exists in a very unique space. First of all, he's always worked in local news. And I think for a lot of journalists, at least the ones that I went to school with, grad school with, you know, have aspirations of working in national news. And I think that's where a lot of the tension goes. And we all know that local newspapers are really struggling these days. And two, he writes human interest stories, little vignettes, sometimes funny or inspiring, sometimes somber. And these are vignettes that bring the community to life in a way that hard news coverage doesn't quite do. So in this episode, we talk about the purpose and value of these types of stories, as well as his personal strategies for bringing them to life in the paper. All right, without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Chris Smith.
Good idea. Great idea.
And it's, I mean, it's kind of selfish reasons. A lot of it is just I get to learn. So
well,
I love it.
If you're learning, then somebody who's listening is going to be learning something too.
There you go. So cool. So we just get into it?
Might as well.
All right. Chris Smith, thank you so much for joining me on the Austin Meyer podcast.
Nice to have you here in my my hut.
Yeah, so where are we right now?
We're on the second floor of the Press Democrat building in downtown Santa Rosa, a block and a half from Courthouse Square.
So this is my local newspaper. Very proud of it. And how long have you been working here?
I'm 41 years.
Wow.
41 years came. Actually, I started writing for them in the fall of 1977, and it's now the fall of 2018.
So. Was this your first newspaper job, or did you come from, what else did you do beforehand?
I grew up in Riverside, California, down by, not far from Disneyland, and worked for my local newspaper down there. It was called the Riverside Press Enterprise, still is. And I had been a paper boy and then worked for them all through high school. And then they gave me work during the summers. And so they did give me a start as a general assignment reporter. And I worked for them for a few months. And I was just kind of itching to be somewhere else, try something else. You know, I'd lived in Riverside, Southern California all my life. And through a very serendipitous course that I won't go into, I wound up finding a job at a weekly on the coast of Mendocino, tiny little town up in Mendocino County, a little community weekly. And I did that for a few months, and then another entire stroke of luck informed me about a position here with the Press Democrat, which is, you know, we're the largest daily between, say, San Francisco and Portland.
Okay.
You know, we're a regional daily newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I heard about a position here. And I got it, and that was a stringer, a correspondent, you know, not a staff position. But I did that for 5 months and then got on with the Press Democrat February of 1978. So, yeah, I've been here for a little over 40 years.
So you started in the newspaper business by throwing papers onto people's driveways?
Well, essentially, that
yeah,
was...
Yeah, you're the paper boy,
yeah,
right?
I was paper boy in the afternoon at the Riverside Press, absolutely.
So did you grow up having the newspaper on the breakfast table? Or, like, what was your relationship with, we'll say, local news when you were growing up?
Well, I was a peruser of the local paper. I'll admit to you that I can't tell you that I was a serious reader of my own newspaper. Mm-hmm. We did subscribe. Actually, I think it helped that they gave us the paper for half price since I was a paper boy. And I think my folks continue to get the Press Enterprise for free or for half price for like 20 years after I left, something like that. That was a bookkeeping screw up. But anyway, I was not an avid newspaper reader, I'll tell you the truth. But I did find out by the time I was in fifth or sixth grade that I liked to write. Hmm. And I think I started with limericks. You know, we're learning limericks. Mm-hmm. And then the pivotal moment in my career really was with my seventh and eighth grade English teacher, who she either started or reinvigorated a student newspaper at what they used to call junior high school. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine told me that he was going to do it, and I went with him. And I found that I really enjoyed the challenge of talking to someone, hearing their story, and then trying to convey that story in a, you know, lively and true manner. You know, and obviously I didn't do it very well back then, but I enjoy that challenge to talk to someone and then hopefully convey it in a way that somebody feels like they were there, or at least I get it right, you know. And I enjoyed it. And then when I left junior high school, that English teacher took me aside and very specifically encouraged me to consider journalism. So I was here at, 15 years old. And I thought, you know, that sounds right. There was nothing, you know, I hadn't been headed for anything else particularly. And so then I went right on to high school and did... was with the school paper and then on to journalism school, and here I am. So,
very cool. So, what are some ways in which, I'm sure there's tons of ways, but I'm curious to hear about what the Press Democrat was like, this local paper, when you first joined, to what it's like now? What are some of the things that feel like the most notable changes that have really shaped the way that you guys tell stories?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it certainly occurs to me that it doesn't really answer your question, but we are much smaller now than we were there. You know, the industry has retracted, you know, and shrunk. And so there may be half as many people in the newsroom as there were. And so we're all the more determined to try to serve the community and try to retain our readers mm-hmm. and remain relevant to them. I think maybe the newspaper now is less about covering the bureaucracy, covering government, which we still do, and we do it aggressively, but we're also trying much more to tell stories and to be on the street more, because I think we are aware that people, they want to read stories about their community beyond the politics and criminal justice, and, you know, those weighty journalistic issues that have to be covered. You know, our primary reason for being is to watch the government, to be, you know, watchdogs. But in addition to the bureaucracy and crime and all that, I think that the Press Democrat is ever more aware that people want to read stories about their community, want to know what's going on in their community, and how they can navigate their community. How they, you know, can afford to live here, and where there's an affordable hamburger. And we know that people love to read their names in the paper, and they love to read their neighbors' names in the newspaper. And I think we all, more than ever, we do value the power of the story. And so I think we are trying more and more to be on the streets and conveying what this community is about.
So, in that, does that mean that people have become less curious about local politics and what's happening in city council?
Well, it could be. You know, when you start asking about why there's a decline in readership of local newspapers, I would have to think that right now, I mean, this is a, as obviously doesn't have to be said, this is a very peculiar time in the United States. And, you know, I just read a story out of West Virginia, I believe it was, it talks about people deciding they're not going to vote anymore. Just they've become hardened and cynical. And I do think that given the current tenor of the times, I have a hunch that people are turning away from interest in government because they've become embittered. I do think that. I could be wrong about this, but I think probably there are a higher percentage of people who are not that avid about following what's going on at City Hall and the Board of Supervisors, just because their lives are more demanding, you know, to live in this area. You can imagine, you know, you've got a couple of kids in school and you're trying to pay the rent, and it's tougher than ever, you know, to make ends meet. And I think that, I do believe that just the demands of life leave people feeling like they don't have the time and they just have more important things in their life than reading the newspaper and staying up on what's going on in their community. I think just the press of life. So I think there's probably a lot of reasons that people are, they're not reading as much about their government. They probably, and voter turnout isn't what it used to be. I think a lot of forces, I think, are pulling people away from caring.
So that makes me think of the stories, the types of stories that you write seem to fit perfectly in line with where you're saying the trend of local news has gone, which is to that small town community feel, personal stories. So for people who haven't read your work, how would you describe the types of stories that you write?
Well, I, like yourself, enjoy the story, the vignette, the moment. And so I will get a call, say, and it may sound petty, but, you know, I'll get a story when someone is talking to their neighbor and their neighbor says that they were working in the yard yesterday and they heard a crash and they went inside and they saw that a fish had fallen from the sky and crashed through the garage, through the tile roof, and they had this fish come through the tile of their, how'd that happen? And this is not what you would call a major news story, but it's curious, where'd the fish come from, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you make some calls and figure out that, you know, there were these egrets or herons hanging around people's koi ponds, you know, and recreate this scene where this egret was flying over and dropped the fish. Or I get a call when, you know, like somebody's kid gets selected as an astronaut or wins a dance contest. I just had a woman call me today. I don't know if I'll use it, but she has a son who is struggling with traumatic stress after having served in the military, and she made a beautiful quilt and she's sending it off to the fellow who created the Wounded Warriors campaign. And she let me know about that. So, you know, I hear people call me when something happens that they think is just kind of fun or interesting. Sometimes it's sad. But so these are definitely the sorts of stories that people might be talking about at work, you know. And then typically it's not the person it happens to who calls me, but it might be the next door neighbor or friend and say, hey, I don't know if you're interested, but this I just heard this story from this part of town. And I'll call them. And so for what in my column, I write, I might have two or three or four or five of those mm-hmm. small stories.
Yeah, so you have a number of small stories per column.
Right.
So yeah. I imagine you're getting calls all the time with story ideas. Plus, you're a member of this community. You have your own story and ideas all the time. How do you evaluate which ones are worth pursuing, reporting, going after?
Well, you know, there's just that kind of that sparkle quality, you know, the glitter that comes from gold, you know. Mm. And when you hear that story, that just kind of sparkles and shines or surprises you, then that's the one you go for. So sometimes I'll have a column pretty much written or close to written, but then I'll get a call or an email telling me about relating a story to me, and it's just so good that I will write it and then kind of save the other ones for tomorrow. But they're just, you know, everybody knows just that feeling when it clicks, mm-hmm. you know, when it's a story worth hearing, mm-hmm. you know, whether it makes you laugh or it makes you cry or it surprises you or it charms you. And so I do tend to gravitate to the more hopeful, maybe humorous, touching, amusing stories. I wrote one recently that I was delighted to hear about. Years ago, we had a real life TV show come here and build a family a house. They lived in an old farmhouse in Pengrove. And these people would come in, they knocked the house down and put up $1.5 million house. And the reason they did that is because a 12-year-old girl in that family had written to this TV show, it's called Extreme Makeover Home Edition, and asked them to come build a home because she was essentially allergic to sunlight. Hmm. And the old farmhouse let in a lot of light, and she had to spend a lot of time in the house, and it's a funky house. And so this TV show came and they made a house that worked for her. They put a pool with a cover, and they put in all of this light shielding just for her. So this kid grew up, and it turns out that she has become a writer. And she's now about 26. She's been published in the New York Times.
Wow.
So there's the reason, as an example, why I like that story, because it was a good story at the time. This house, by the way, was the old house was destroyed and the new house built in 1 week.
Wow.
They built a new house in a week.
Wow.
And they had the family go to Washington, D.C. and go sightseeing while they did this. And so a lot of people would remember when that happened. And so you get to recall the story, or then if people didn't know the story, I get to introduce them to the story and then bring them up to speed. You know, there was a similar one recently. One of the most incredible stories that I've covered had to do with a boy named Nicholas Green, who lived in Bodega Bay, a remarkable family, an international family. They did a lot of traveling. And Nicholas, I believe, was 8 years old, and his family went to Italy. And they were driving at night on a highway, and some highway robbers came up, tried to get them to pull over, and they didn't, and a shot was fired. And Nicholas Green's parents finally pulled over when it was safe, and they realized that Nicholas Green, 8 years old, this wonderful little kid from Bodega Bay, had taken a bullet to the head and was still, his respiration was still happening, but he was near death. And these folks, Reginald Green and his wife, donated all of his organs. And it truly changed the nature and the acceptance of organ donation. This was Reg and Maggie Green donated their boy's organs to 7 Italians and thereby saved lives and prolonged life. Well, it was a huge international story, massive story, and it truly changed people's attitudes about organ donation. Mm-hmm. It improved like threefold in Italy. And the reason I mention that is just recently, his younger sister, who was 6, I believe, at the time, and now lives in Los Angeles, came back here to be married in Bodega Bay. Mm-hmm. And she was married alongside this beautiful bell tower that's out in Bodega Bay alongside Highway 1. And there's 100 bells from all around Italy on that bell tower. And in the wind, they chime. And if any place she could have been married, Nicholas Green's sister decided to be married alongside his bell tower. So there again, you know, that's just a, it's a powerful story. And if people here had never, those people here who'd never heard of Nicholas Green, I was able to kind of, happy to be able to introduce them to Nicholas Green. And for the ones who were here, of course, they would remember, they'd never forget. So those are the people stories that I love, you know. But it could be from the tiniest silly, it could be, you know, as silly as a comment from a kid heard in a Safeway line, you know.
But yeah,
I think people eat them up, you know, and it's kind of an antidote to so much of the news, which is, and all the news has to be reported. You know, we can't just be writing about sweetness and light in the Press Democrat. We have to cover it all, but it's nice to have a little leavening and a little humanity in there also.
So it's really evident when you write a story like the one you just shared in from Bodega Bay, the impact that that has, right? This story seemed to have struck a chord with people and really opened up new perspectives about organ donation,
yeah.
Like I said. What kind of impact do you hope those stories that are lighter have? The story about the fish falling through the roof, or the story about that comment in a Safeway line. What do you hope is the impact of those types of stories in a local newspaper?
I would hope, and I've thought about this some, I would hope that these stories help bind and unite us as a community. That you're aware that this happened, that something happened to this person in Cotati or in Cloverdale or in Healdsburg or in Sonoma. You're aware that it happened and you feel connected to it and you feel bound to the community. You're like, without it, say you live, in the worst case scenario, you live in a town but you don't know anybody, you don't read the newspaper, you don't know what's going on. You know, you might see a big crane in the sky, but you don't know what it's doing, you know, or whatever. You're just not aware. And so you're here, but you're not a part, you're not a part of it, right? You're just kind of living your life and you're not particularly connected with the community. Well, I love the idea that there's a story that's told, and it's told again and again, and it's shared, and it binds the community. You know, often it is, sometimes there are stories that you can actually do something about. So say, it could be as simple as there's a benefit car wash to benefit a family that had a tragedy. Well, you can read that and you might actually go get your car washed and drop $5 and help. But the short answer is I have thought of it that the role of the newspaper and the role of the stories that I tell, that I hope that they function sort of like the circulation system or the blood vessels of a body function, carrying oxygen throughout the entire body, keeping the toes alive, right? The toes are out there, but they better be connected or they're going to fall off, you know? And so I like to think that these stories that circulate through the community and kind of oxygenate the community and keep people bound to it and interested in feeling a part of it and feeling in the know. You know, they know these things happened and they're happy to know and they're eager to learn what happens tomorrow. And, you know, sometimes I'll write about somebody and it's nice, people will call and they'll ask, hey, would you follow up? How did that turn out? Mm. You know, how did that work out? You know, so that they're interested. So that's what I would hope, is that it helps the reader feel as a part of the community. That's my role in this town, and I do love it, is that everybody has a role, everybody's job is important. And my job is, when something happens, is to share that information and move it throughout the community so that everybody can know about it and benefit from it and be a part of it and act if they want. Mm-hmm. So that's what I hope for.
I'd love to talk a little bit about the specifics of your craft and how you report stories. And I'm wondering if it'd be valuable to maybe pick a particular story, whether it's the Bodega Bay one or maybe something recent, and talk about the whole process from finding the story to going out for those initial interviews, how you interview. So maybe we can start with something around the fires. So maybe for people who aren't aware of the fires we've had in Santa Rosa in the anniversary we just have, maybe you could give a brief overview of that and then talk about how you in your kind of reporting, how did you go about trying to find a story that balances out the kind of breaking news nature that mm-hmm. maybe everyone else in the newsroom was reporting?
Well, these fires, we're speaking now in October of 2018, and in October of 2017, these wildfires that were driven by winds up to, we hear, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, struck in the middle of the night, and people were fleeing their homes, and it was total chaos here in Sonoma County. These fires swept in from the east and incinerated entire neighborhoods. Unbelievable. You know, it's one thing, it's terrible enough if one house or two houses are lost, but here entire neighborhoods were lost. And there were over 5,000 homes here lost. 24 people died. And one of the saving graces is that it wasn't worse, because again, here it was on a Sunday night, 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday night, and it came so fast that the initial fears were that there would be wholesale deaths, scores and scores of deaths. But neighbors woke up, knocked on doors, friends called friends on the phone, police officers banged on doors. There were some, but not much in the way of phone calls, official calls, sirens. At any rate, it was the worst. The Tubbs Fire here in Sonoma, in Santa Rosa, is the most destructive in the history of the state. So there have been, everybody has a story, and there have been stories of heroism. I've talked to a number of people who did knock on doors. They said they weren't leaving until their neighbors left. I've told the story about a woman who was standing out in front of her house, and she saw a firefighter. Amazingly, he came up. He said, "Get in the truck." She said, "I have to get my cats. I have to get my cats." He says, "No, we'll die. Get in the truck. And by the way, your nightgown is on fire." Yeah, so here this woman standing there worrying about her cats, and he points out to her their nightgown is fire, and if they don't leave now, they're going to die. And there was, so that she had to leave without the cats. But there have been, the stories will continue to be told forever, because everyone had one.
What's one that you've written in relation to the fires that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I'll tell you one that I just...
And maybe you can kind of walk us through from beginning to the end of it, just so I can get a sense of your process as a reporter.
Okay.
How it came on your radar.
Good. Well, one that occurs to me, because I've written about it lately, is, and we talked about it a moment, is about the Texas Longhorn cow named Angel. So right here in Santa Rosa, on Highway 101, right about the place where the fire leaped down from the hills and then leaped Highway 101 and then went into this flatland where it took out the Coffee Park neighborhood. And a lot of people have heard about Coffee Park. It was a traditional flatland neighborhood, nice middle-class neighborhood. no one would ever imagine that it was any particular fire danger. It's just a neighborhood in a flat area. You know, there's some trees, but nothing particularly dangerous. But the fire swept across the highway and then into Coffee Park and burnt 1,000 homes or so. And there were deaths there also. Well, right at that point where it jumped the highway, there's a small farm, a small ranch, and people driving by for years and years noticed this cow standing there, a Texas Longhorn. We don't see a lot of Texas Longhorn.
No.
Cows.
We don't see that a lot.
And I was vaguely aware of it, but then I got the question one day, what happened to Angel? Well, I'm not sure I knew the cow's name was Angel.
Someone just asked, randomly.
What happened to the cow? Because they're getting, it wasn't the next day.
Yeah.
There's clearly bigger fish to fry and greater questions to answer. But at some point, people driving by in that area see that the house is gone and burned. And where's the cow? Where's Angel? And again, I don't want anybody to think like this was the biggest story we had. This is some weeks after the fire.
Right.
So I know I went in search of Angel and found out that Angel survived the fire, but that Angel's keeper perished, and the family was getting out, and her name is Valerie Evans, and she's a woman in her 70s. She was a fairly well-known equestrian, and she went back into the house to get her dog, an elderly dog, and didn't get out. So Valerie and the dog died. And then a short while after, some weeks after the fire, someone put up a billboard. And it's a black and white photo of Angel, and then it says, in memory of Valerie Evans. And so it's kind of tributing both the cow and Valerie. Well, just recently, I found out that the cow was living. The family moved into a temporary place down in Pengrove, a few miles to the south. And then just recently, someone told me that they had seen on the truck a sculpture, a likeness of a Longhorn cow. And so I found the woman who had created it. And this is a woman who did not lose her home to the fire, but has been, she's very empathetic. She's been suffering since the fire. Mm-hmm. And wanting.
So did you, is this all information that you're learning when you actually went to meet her?
I reached her on the telephone.
Okay, so you found out this person made this replica of the cow that had burned.
The cow, right.
And spoke so
with her.
You called her up.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then I called the family that owns the cow. And
at this point, are you just trying to kind of get the chronology and the basic storyline together?
Well, yes, because here somebody says, hey, I saw a sculpture on a truck of the cow. What's that about?
Yeah, you're like, I don't know.
That's a very good question. Why? What's up with this sculpture of a Texas Longhorn? So I reached the woman, and she just very much wanted to do something constructive, something helpful after this fire, because there was so much hurting out there. And people's lives have been totally disrupted. They've lost their home. Their people don't know if they're going to be able to rebuild their homes. They don't know if they're going to be able to continue living here. Their lives have been turned upside down by this fire. So she wanted to do something. Well, one day she was driving by there and she realized that she didn't know what happened to Angel the cow either. And she found out that Angel was still alive. And she has a friend who is a sculptor, a junk sculptor, and she decided maybe she could do something for this family. And it turns out that her husband works at a bank, and her husband knew the son of Valerie who died. And one day, the son of the woman who made the sculpture said, could I have something of your mother's? So in essence, the woman who's making the sculpture wanted something personal from Valerie Evans. And the son is thinking, what is that about? But he gave her a brooch that he had found in the rubble of the fire. So it's this damaged brooch that his mother had worn on her sweaters, the woman who died in the fire. And he gave up that brooch. And the next thing you know, this woman is asking if she can come and give the family something, and she pulls up with a truck, and here you've got a junk sculpture of the cow, and right between its ears, on the top of his head, are some wires for hair, and within those wires for hair is set this brooch that had belonged to the woman who died on the ranch where Angel lived. And there were tears, and this kindness, this totally random act of kindness after this fire, this family that lost Valerie Evans is just unspeakably grateful. And there's been a lot more from the community to them. There's also been a GoFundMe account that I've written about, where people are helping them to afford to rebuild their home. So, you know, this is, it's just a little story about a longhorn cow that millions have seen there alongside the highway, but who would have known that, you know, that its master died in the fire, and that her family now is very determined to come back onto that land, mm-hmm. and eventually they'll be there, and the cow will be there back on that land, and this sculpture of the cow will be there.
When you write, so let's take that story as an example, you are constrained by space.
Definitely.
Your stories have to be really tight.
Yeah.
What are some strategies, or how do you bring out all that emotion that's clearly behind this story while also being very concise and sticking to those limits that you need to?
Yeah. Well, I start off being as lean as I can and trying to have a good idea when I start is what is the essence. And then sometimes I'll write things in it that I have a hunch I won't be able to keep.
So let's go through this story as an example, yeah. Right? So the essence. Talk me through what you were thinking with this story particularly.
Well, I think when I started the story, I want first to remind people of the cow. And actually, you know, the story is a lot more about the cow than the cow. Of course, we're talking about a woman who died. But as I start in, I want to take people to that place on Highway 101 where that cow had stood. So, excuse me, reminding people that if they've driven by, they saw the cow. If they didn't drive by, I'm setting the stage to tell them where this cow was. But I start with the cow.
So the cow and where the cow is and kind of the setting there, that's your lead-in.
Yeah.
But the essence, what do you feel is the essence of the story?
Well, I think the essence of the story is that what's happened around this cow is evidence of the kindness and caring and sense of community in this place, in Santa Rosa and in Sonoma County, that showed itself ever more forcefully after these fires.
Mm. Okay.
Incredible caring. And the outpouring that has come to this family that lost Valerie in the fire, the caring is about them, and the curiosity that came about, the curiosity that was shown in the caring about the cow. What happened to the cow? What happened to the cow? So, yeah, it's a story, excuse me, a story that stars a cow, but that has everything to do with the compassion of a community that's hurting.
So when you start the story, your lead is setting the stage for where this cow is, what it was, and then how do you move from there?
Well,
or what else are you thinking? Like, back to my original question about capturing the emotion of that story in such a constrained space.
I will tell you that sometimes I have to cut, and so sometimes I'll write the story knowing that it has to be cut, and then go back and just start trimming like the leaves away that are the least essential. But it certainly involves, you know, setting the stage and then as quickly as possible getting into the narrative of how this woman who was suffering, how she came to the decision of tributing this family, creating a tribute for this family in a junk sculpture. So I think I have to quickly let people know that where we are here. You know, we're here alongside Highway 101, where the fire jumped and where this cow was. And there's one of the women, one of the people who had enjoyed seeing that cow, getting into her narrative of how she's been suffering since these fires, and she has this yearning to do something and decides that she's going to do it with a sculpture that bears a piece of jewelry, something that had been dear to the woman who died in the fire. So I think that's it, just, you know, a start that places you, and then as quickly as possible getting into the narrative of sort of recreating how the story opened itself to me, the discovery.
And then I also noticed, and I'm curious about your decision for this, when I read the story, when the person who is kind of building the cow,
when
she asks for the item for the woman who has passed away,
right,
I, as the reader, am thinking, what does she want that for?
Well, yeah.
I didn't really know until the end there's the reveal that it's been placed on top of this cow and is now completed, kind of this symbol.
Well, exactly. So,
and so I'm wondering about your choice to kind of let that be a reveal.
Definitely. It's more like writing a story, sort of like a kid's story, if you will, as opposed to the classic pyramid, the inverted pyramid of the news story. So with the inverted pyramid of the news story, you go from the most important thing to the least important thing. And so, boom, Judge Kavanaugh was sworn in on whatever day to the Supreme Court, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. But in the kind of stories I can write, I can do more like a once upon a time and reveal, you know, just like with Jack and the Beanstalk or whatever, I don't have to put the most important, I don't have to put in the lead that that a piece of jewelry that belonged to a woman who died in the fire sits now between the ears of a junk sculpture cow.
So that would be the inverse pyramid, right?
Right, to get it right up there, the most important, the news of the event,
mm-hmm.
you know, is we have this brooch
mm-hmm.
that was salvaged from the fire, and now it's in this sculpture. But I don't have to write it that way. I don't have to get the most important thing right up there. I can, like you say, reveal. I can tell the story and kind of weave through what happened to get to the surprise ending or that glittery part of the story, that little gem. So it is a different style of writing than breaking news. And it's just a style that I prefer. You know, I've done serious reporting, but I find that I do much more enjoy the story, the human story. And yeah, I don't want to, I would fight with an editor if need be to keep from revealing too soon. You know, that if there's a surprise ending or this sweet little ribbon that you're going to put at the bottom of the story, I want to leave it there. I don't want to move it up.
Mm-hmm. In this story and in others that have had to deal with death, with the fire destroying homes, I'm sure you've had lots of interviews that were very emotional, very intense. I'm wondering for people out there who are listening who are trying to become better interviewers themselves or might come upon that situation where they have to have tough conversations. I'm wondering, how do you approach difficult interviews, and how do you get the most out of, or how, not get the most, but I guess get the most authentic version of the story from people when it can be hard to talk about?
Yeah. Well, I think just like our conversation or most natural conversations, you don't just start off and then strike at the heart. You know, it's not like you're a cop interviewing a homicide suspect, you know. Where were you? You know, I know you did it. You know, no, you're talking with someone who, like you're saying, may have a painful story to tell. And so you have a casual conversation with them and let it follow its course. And then if you get the idea that they'd like to say more, or there's more to say, then you just ask the question and try to guide them to let, you know, to reveal more and more. You know, or could you say a little more about that? Or what was it that happened after you told me that this happened? What was it that happened right after that? Or, you know, or as simple as, could you tell me more about that? And either they will or they won't. But, you know, it's just like having a conversation with a person in an airplane or at a bus station. I think either you're going to get a good feeling about the person, that this is someone you care to have this conversation with, or you're not. And I think if a reporter comes off as kind of brusque and too demanding in a story like this, again, we're not talking about interviewing a governor who's accused of absconding public funds. We're talking to a member of the community who had a powerful experience. And so I think you just want to, you know, you want to show that you're genuinely interested and that you're trustworthy. And if they really do not want to go there somewhere, then I tend to, you know, after a little bit of attempt, I'll back off. But you know, obviously I'm just trying to have a conversation with this person. And then you can, you know, gently return if they think that there's an aspect that you would like to explore more. Because, you know, clearly sometimes there is, say you were talking about somebody's death, and sometimes they don't want to talk about the cause of death, or they don't want to get too specific. And so you just gently ask, well, could I ask you a little more about how that happened? You know, what happened there? What did you see? And either they're going to go there or they're not. But I think it's just a process of sitting down, having the conversation, and letting it unfold.
When you, this might be a kind of funny question, but I'm just interested in really small specifics of how people do their job. And for you, when you go into interviews, are you bringing you know, a pen and a notebook? Is it a computer? How do you take notes? Well, and how do you bring this stuff back to...
I am old school.
Okay.
I'm very old school.
Great.
Yeah. So I have my reporter's notebook, which fits in your back pocket.
Uh-huh.
I know your listeners can't see it, but so it's about 4 inches wide and about 10 inches long, and it's got this steel spiral.
Yep. Vertical notebook.
Yep. Vertical notebook. It goes in your pocket. And I will tell you that I've had people watching me write, and they go, how can you read that? And I tell them, you know, I need to get to it while it's fresh. I need to get to it while it's fresh, because I kind of scribble. And all the time I've been at the Press Democrat, I've been aware of one reporter who was trained in shorthand. And other than that, most reporters now do use recorders. They use the recording app on their phone, and they record it. I just prefer to write notes, and if I get a little behind, I might ask them, what was that word you used? You know, I got a little behind you. Because clearly, as you know, as I'm writing, you're trying to get it down verbatim. You have to get it down verbatim if you're going to use a direct quote. It has to be exactly what they said.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just scribble furiously. and hope for the best. I mean, if sometimes it has happened, I'll admit that I come back and I did not, maybe I can't read a word, or I got a little behind. Well, then you write around it. I wouldn't use it as a direct quote, but I do use the old notebook.
Mm, all right.
But I would say most people by now are using some sort of electronic, but then you have to go back and you have to listen to the whole thing over again. Mm-hmm. One thing that I enjoy is I'd rather see the person in person, but if I'm on the phone, then I'm writing on the keyboard.
Okay.
And, I think maybe I'm a little faster on the keyboard and a little more accurate than just writing. And then another thing that happens now, and I don't do it overly, but I think we all do some, is that you pose questions to the person, or maybe pose follow-up questions. You've interviewed someone live, and then you realize, I'd like a little more about this and a little more about that, and I might email or text them.
Okay.
And I think that's wonderful, because now they've written it, and you've got it in their words.
Right, right.
You know, they wrote it in their words, and it's, to me, it's the same as a direct quote, mm-hmm. and it's right there in black and white. Mm-hmm. You
know. Speaking of, because you said we're old school, yeah. Some reporters in here are using recorders and stuff. I'm just thinking about how the evolution of the Press Democrat and just newspapers in general, now that so much is moving online.
Oh, yeah.
In what ways have you had to change your game as a reporter or columnist because of that?
Well, we do try to get something onto the web as soon as possible, because a newspaper website has to be dynamic. And if people read it at 8 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning, they don't want to come back 3 hours later and see that there's no new content. So I do try to post something to the web. Sometimes, say if I'm writing an obituary. I do a fair number of obituaries, and I find that they are rewarding also, that someone here in our community who has contributed to the community, and perhaps it's a very obvious VIP, and maybe it's somebody that they didn't know, that people didn't know as well, but who had an interesting life. I will write the obituary, and sometimes what I would do is write the first 6 or 8 paragraphs and then submit that for posting at PressDemocrat.com, so that we get it out there and it's on the website. And that's generally, here is the main difference in the business since I started. Because of course, when I started, the Press Democrat was an afternoon paper, and so we would come in here. I'd come in, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, start writing, get your assignment, and then write on a typewriter. And then correct your own type, your own copy with a soft lead pencil and turn it into an editor who might tear it twice and move a paragraph up and glue it.
Wow.
Yeah. And then pass that to somebody who had to type every word again, every character again. And when I started, there were Linotype machines. And these are these old guys with the green visors, and they're at the keyboard, and as when they push an R, a piece of lead with a backwards R moves into place in lead. So things have changed. But so clearly back then, and this gets more into newspapering, but back then, say it was 1982, things are happening, and people don't know they're happening because they haven't read the newspaper yet, because the newspaper's not out yet. Unless there's a radio station, you didn't have cell phones, and people, they didn't know it happened until we told them it happened. Mm-hmm. And so we'd work until about 11 or 12, and then we have the deadline, and then the paper comes out at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon and hits some kid delivers it to your porch at,
You.
Me, probably. And now, of course, and so you write the story and you're done. You write it once. Well, now, of course, the pressure and the goal is to get it online ASAP. Mm. And as, you know, as soon as you feel like you actually have it, you yeah. know, and you know what you're talking about. So that's one of the big changes, is that we should be writing up something for the web as soon as possible and getting that posted.
Do you feel like there's some risks to that?
Well, I do because, again, you know, before you might research and talk to people or go to the scene, but you might do the reporting for 2 or 3 or 4 hours before submitting a story. And now, to get it on the web, you might do 15 minutes of reporting. And so, you know, you just have to be careful to not write what you don't know. And so, you know, you obviously, we all know now that these news bulletins happen constantly. So we might say, you know, there are reports that an airplane crashed in East Petaluma. There's visible smoke, and there were fire engines were running to the scene, this or that. One man who we spoke to said he saw a small plane. Anyway, you write what you know and then get there and then and elaborate. But I do think, you know, it just stands to reason to me that there are risks with accuracy, because right now, as you know, everybody, when something happens, everybody wants to be the first, and it starts hitting the web and Facebook and everywhere else just almost instantaneously.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, I know we're almost at time here, so I have just a couple more questions. You know, it seems like the way people consume news right now, first of all, it's mostly national news. It's mostly national news. It's the big headlines. And, you know, a lot of my friends, it's getting your news through either Facebook headlines or even just like tweets.
Right.
Right? And the types of stories that you write do not lend themselves to that.
No.
Right?
No.
So I'm wondering if you could make kind of a case for the value of reading these types of human interest stories, whether they're within your community or maybe it's a human interest story that's put in the New York Times. Why should people take the time to read those?
Well, I think it feels good, and that there are intangible benefits to knowing what's going on in your community, you know, to again feeling part of it. And I know that that's not everybody's cup of tea, and I completely understand if somebody says to me, I get my news from the New York Times. Well, I understand that. I obviously do. The New York Times is the voice of authority for the entire country. I understand that. But what's happening across town, what's happening in your own town, you know, I guess you're either interested in that or not, but I believe it enriches your life. I really do believe it enriches your life to be involved in your community and to know what's happening in your town. And we also understand that people just don't have as much time. And we understand, you know, there are a lot of forces that cause people not to read a local newspaper. But I find it very enriching that virtually every day I have somebody tell me, and they are typically not young people, I'll tell you that, that I have to...
I'm here for you.
Thank you. I have to read that newspaper. I love reading what's going on in my town. And I tell you that, and I will have people who say that they appreciate what I do because it is something human, flesh and blood and real, and, well, not that the other stuff isn't real, but it's human and often is hopeful and life-confirming as kind of a counterweight to some very heavy things happening in this world. They always have happened, but there's plenty now. And now, and also now, there's always been heavy things happening, you know, serious, troubling things happen in the nation and the world. But now, more than ever, it is in your face. You know, it happens, and it could happen in Turkey, but 10 minutes later, you know about it. Mm-hmm. And as just a counterbalance to that, these other things are happening too. The fish falling from the sky happened too. And I think I appreciate there are a lot of people who appreciate knowing about it. And it makes them feel like right now we're writing so much about the humanistic, caring response to the fire. People say they need that news. You know, if it's all, hey, people are homeless and they're moving and it's terrible, 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 it dims your view of life, you know? And those things are true, but I think people find it helps to get up in the morning to be reminded that there is still kindness, there is still hope, people are, you know, there are people who are thriving, you know, amidst all of the, you know, the gloomier and tougher stuff. So I don't know, I think it makes you a better human being to read the local newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and for me, I'd say about the type of stories that you write, and I often will enjoy reading the New York Times versions of what you do, you know, whether it's a story about a plumber, you know, the life story of someone. I love to do, you know, portraits of people and tell a little bit about their lives as well. And for me, I think you may have mentioned it at the beginning of this, but it just makes the world feel a little bit smaller, like you're connected to people in a little bit different way. And it makes me, when I walk down the street and pass by people, mm-hmm. it just reminds me that everyone has those types of stories in their life.
Well, they do, and I think that's very well put. It makes it tangible, it makes it real to see people in a little closer to three dimensions. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just read the stories of the world and people are being killed and this and those happen, people become sort of two-dimensional to you. But you read these stories of humanity and the richness of personalities and what people are experiencing, and it does make them more real, and you see them more as human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important because we're all in this together.
Yeah. So I think I'll wrap with this question, which I've asked a couple of my guests so far. One of the reasons that I wanted to start this podcast was for people who are looking to become better storytellers in whatever it is that they do, whether it's a marketing campaign at their work or whether they are a professional storyteller. You know, I asked Lisa Rowland on episode one, which was, what can we learn from the way improvisers tell stories? Steve Starkey in episode two, I asked him, you know, what can we learn from cinema? From movies, what do they do that is unique, and what can we try to apply if you want to be a better storyteller, mm-hmm. even if it's just around your dinner table?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm wondering what kind of lessons we can learn from what you do as someone who reports the local stories, who doesn't use the inverted pyramid of typical mm-hmm. newspaper reporting and tells those human interest stories. What are some ways that we can take that and become better storytellers ourselves?
Well, I think it helps to be fascinated, and we want to remain fascinated by people because they are fascinating. And life is just more interesting when you're appreciating that human beings are interesting people. And beyond the issues and the headlines and all the troubles, human beings are trying to figure out how to get by in this crazy world, and we can help each other. You know, when if people do things that are kind, I wrote several times about people who are out there in the middle of the night looking for other people's cats, from the fire. And in addition to just shedding some light on some people doing some wonderful things, I hope it also inspires other people to think about what they might do. You know, hey, I could do something for somebody else. So I think that if you let other people be examples, and if you read about somebody who's doing something interesting, something worthwhile, something funny, I think we can be inspired by them, and can actually make ourselves more interesting.
Great. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Inviting me to your office. Thank you so much.
Come anytime.
Is there anything else? Where would you point people to find your work?
Well,
if they're curious reading more?
PressDemocrat.com.
Okay.
That'd be the main place. Chris Smith at PressDemocrat.com, and I'm very happy to hear from people.
He accepts emails, everybody.
I love emails, love phone calls.
Great.
And just keep reading those newspapers. You know, it's not a pleasant feeling to imagine a country and a community without a vigorous local newspaper. If you haven't read one for a while, you might want to read two or three, because you pick it up the first day, it might not have been much of a day, but give us two or three shots.
There you go.
Because, you know, we're trying to continue telling the stories. Thanks a lot, man.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for episode 3. Thanks again to Chris Smith for joining me. One thing that stood out for me when I walked out of this interview was the fact that whatever you look for in the world will manifest itself. So Chris, oftentimes he looks for these vignettes. He looks for positivity and generosity in the community. He keeps an eye out for levity and spontaneity, and he finds it. He finds it because he's looking for it. It might seem obvious, but I think it's just something that struck me. And I think it's important to remember, because oftentimes the news can make us think everyone and everything is such a negative place. And when we think that way, the world will present itself to us in that way. So after my conversation with Chris, what I'm feeling and what I would encourage you to do is just experiment with ways that you look at the world through different lenses and see how that changes the people, experiences, and stories that present themselves to you. All right, that's it from here. Thanks again for listening, sharing, subscribing, all that good stuff, rating on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever the name is. Okay, and I will see you next week on episode 4 of the Austin Meyer Podcast.